I'm going to pass around sheets for everybody just to sign in your name and your email address. If you are not currently on our list, meaning you do not get emails from me and you're interested in getting emails so that you'll know what's going on, please maybe just make a star next to your name so that I know that you're a new face and a new name. But please write your email address clearly so that I can put it into the computer. Okay, I just want to thank Revison Heller for coming. Every year I get an email from her husband telling me that she's coming, and I get nervous. Is it going to work out this year? Is it not going to work out this year? And Hashem has been so good to us the last number of years. She's always able to work us into her schedule, and we really appreciate it. So thank you so much, Revison. Oh, and one more thing. There are tapes for sale. There are CDs for sale after the share if you're interested on the stage.
Tapes. Soon you'll be telling your kids that in the old days they had tapes. Okay, so there are MP3s, which is what we use nowadays, as well as CDs. Okay, so in any case, let's talk about something that that's controversial. Okay, so before we begin talking about something controversial, let's talk about what the word controversial means. What does it mean? So in order to understand what controversial means, I want you to be in two different headspaces in two different time periods. Put yourself in England, in London, upper class London, 150 years ago. Could you picture that? Okay. And somebody says to you, men should be able to marry men, and women should be able to marry women. What would you say as a member of the English upper class 150 years ago? What would you say? You're crazy. That's a ridiculous idea. It's unnatural. Who ever heard of such a thing? Okay? You have the image? How many of you think that that's probably how you would respond? Okay, now you're, don't even be in Queen's College, let's think of a much more liberal university. Berkeley, okay. You're in Berkeley, and you say, I think that there's more than one side of the coin when you talk about the issue of homosexual marriage. How will that be received in Berkeley? What kind of response will you get from the person who you're talking to? No? Approval? Absolutely not. You're homophobic. You're a hater. Why should there be more of it than one side to this issue? There is no two sides to this issue. Anyone should be able to, okay? You definitely would not get approval. Could you see where this is so? Yeah, how many of you could picture that? Okay. So the reason I'm telling you this is that when you talk about any controversial issue, realize that there's always a bad guy in the picture. Always. I want to tell you who the bad guy is. Human nature. Rambam tells us that it's human nature, not human weakness. I want to stress this. Human nature, not human weakness. To want the approval of the society in which you live. So if you live in a conservative society, it's natural for you want to espouse views that are conservative in order to get more approval. If you live in a liberal society, it's natural for you to espouse views that are liberal to gain approval. Could you see where this is so? How many of you think that there is no such thing as societal influence? How many of you think that there's a high degree of societal influence? So the Jewish view is that there's a very high degree, and I want to tell you what it comes from. The Gemara tells us that before a child is born, when the child is in its mother's womb, an angel comes and teaches it the entire Torah, which is where, in psychology, what they would call gestalt moral information, the gestalt of moral information comes from. Even a very young child will use words like, it's not fair! And if you say, who says things should be fair? It doesn't fly. Okay, here's an experiment you could make with a young child. Okay, the reason I'm giving you young children as an example is because that shows that it's not just a consequence of societal influence. If you tell a very young child, a 2.5-year-old, a 3-year-old, you point at an object that they know. They know how to describe this object in words, for instance, chair. And you insist on calling it something else, horseradish. Okay, how do they respond? Fury. They get very angry. And I want to tell you why. It's because the love of truth and consistency is inherent. So all of the inherents about human morality are a consequence of our deep mystic knowledge of truth that we all have from before we're born. Before a child could be born to the world, the angel will slap the child and cause the child to forget all of this learning. So it's there, but it's forgotten. So it's subconscious, not conscious. But one more thing happens, and this is the crux of what we're talking about. Before the child is born, the angel makes the child make an oath. Be righteous, don't be wicked. And that's clause A. And even if the whole world tells you that you're righteous, in your own eyes will be as though you're wicked. And until the oath is made, the child can't be born. Is this oath conscious? No, it's subconscious. Let's look at the two clauses. Be righteous. We all want to feel that we're right. When people live bad lives, what do? They redefine good and evil so they can now say they're living good lives. Could you see where people do this? We all have a need to be right. But then there's another need. Even if the whole world tells you that you're righteous, in your own eyes you'll be as though you're wicked. You'll never really believe you're okay. So I wanted to illustrate this to you. Is it accurate to say that all of you looked in the mirror before you came to school today? Yes or no? How many of you looked in the mirror? So you know the truth. Okay. Now suppose you got to school and somebody says, are you okay? Really, we're friends. You could tell me, like, what's wrong? I see you're a little pale. You know, you have dark shadows under your eyes. You've been gaining a little bit. Something wrong? Now, if you heard this, could you picture yourself feeling as though you don't look okay? Questioning whether you look okay or not? How many of you could picture thinking that? Even though you looked in the mirror. Now suppose the opposite happened. Your friend says, you look marvelous. Something good happening? You lost weight. You look great. Tell me, share it a little. What's happening? Would you believe you looked good? Even though you looked in the mirror and you know what you look like? Okay. So what I'm trying to demonstrate is we trust other people more than we trust ourselves. So this phenomena isn't because of your mother. Okay? This is inherent to human nature. So because of this, we look for approval. So now that we understand this phenomena, it's human nature to seek approval. Do you all think that this is so? How many of you think this is so? How many of you think we don't seek approval? Okay. You have just lost your best excuse. You know what your best excuse is that you may have used numerous times from when you were young, not that you're so old? It's not my fault. It's my friends. It's society. I was influenced. It's not my fault. Like, look where. Okay. So, good morning. Once you admit to yourself that all people are influenced by the environment, whose job is it to choose a good environment? Whose job is it? Mine? Whose job is it? Yours. You lost your best excuse. So for those of you who are addicted to it's not my fault, it's not his fault, in fact it's nobody's fault, it's the environment, let go. People choose their environments. Okay, so now I want to contrast two stories. Okay, you have the story of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. Okay, he lived during the time of the Roman occupation during the Second Temple period. The Romans were miserable, they were oppressive, they were horrific. He was sitting and talking about the Romans with friends. One of them said, the Romans have two sides to their occupation. On one hand, they're very good to us. They've made bridges, they've made bathhouses, aqueducts. Okay. One of the companions said nothing, and Rabbi Shimon said, everything they've done for themselves. They make markets so they could tax us. They make aqueducts so they could charge us for water. It's all self-interest. Okay, so the conversation was repeated to the Romans, and Rabbi Shimon had to end up hiding in a cave for 12 years to avoid persecution, to avoid death. Whose company did he have in this cave? His son, and that's all. Okay, how many of you could even imagine for a moment what it would be like to be in isolation for 12 years? Could you imagine this? It's beyond imagination. Many of us find it hard to be alone for 2 hours. Okay, so I want you to keep this picture in your mind. Okay? So, when you're alone, there is no influence. There is no approval seeking. Okay, so how did he come out of the cave? He came out with such brilliant spiritual vision that he could pierce through any level of unreality. It says he could gaze at a bird and it would fall out of the heavens. Okay, that's what we could be potentially. But now let's look at our actualities. Is it desirable to live in a cave? Put it into words. Why not? Why submit yourself to the influence of society when you could choose isolation from society? So I want to tell you that question is arguably the most central question in Jewish philosophy. The most central question is, to what degree do you put yourself in society? No degree, 100% in, 50% in, 80% in unconditionally, inconditionally. So let's talk about what's at stake. Again, going back to the beginning, we're all societally influenced. So by being in society, you guarantee influence. But B, we were put in this world to bring light to a dark place. If we're alone, the question would be, what are we here in the world for? So let's continue in the Rambam. So he says there are two kinds of influence. The influence of the general society and the influence of friends. So in the general society, okay, everyone wants to seem normal. We love the word normal. We want to fit in. So what I find particularly interesting in American society, where individuality is a value, people will say, I want to be like me. I want to be free to be myself. And that's why I do, let's say, body piercings. Okay? But you only want to strike out your individual note in a way which is consistent with what society is doing. 40 years ago, were people doing body piercings? No. It's only after they became part of society that suddenly people say, I want to be original and do it. Uh-huh. Okay, be 15. You were 15 not that long ago. Okay, a 15-year-old could tell her parents, I want to be who I want to be. And then choose to be like every other teenager. Have you been there? Okay, so when you're talking about societal influence, you're talking about the mores of society, its culture. So let's talk about some things that characterize American culture. Tell me 3 good things about American culture. It's not hard. It's a good culture. No, 3 good things about American culture.
Rights for everyone.
Okay, rights for everyone. Tell me more. There's more. You could say more that's positive. That's it? Think.
Equality.
No? You're in college. Think.
Public education.
What?
Public education.
I'll broaden it. Benefiting all levels of society. Not only are there rights for everyone, but there are benefits for everyone. Public education. What else is a way in which this extraordinarily generous society benefits all people, other than public education?
Freedom of religion.
Okay, again, freedom of religion, public libraries. Okay, these things are unheard of in many places in the world. There's enormous generosity, there's enormous tolerance. I would say that these are the two strongest and most beautiful parts of American culture. Tell me some bad things about American culture. It's money obsessed. It's a very materialistic culture. Tell me more. What? Okay, this goes back to materialism. It's a very material society, very wealth obsessed, body obsessed. One more thing, come on. It tolerates evil. Okay, so I want you to take notice of things because this is true not only of American society, but it's true across the board. Its good points are its bad points. Could you see where I'm coming from? Toleration of all people, when taken to extreme, leads to tolerance of evil. Generosity and validation leads to generosity and validation of things that really shouldn't be validated or treated generously. Sharing wealth leads to materialism. Okay, so we like to be normal in society. So that means just by virtue of breathing the air, odds are everybody in this room is more tolerant, more generous than their grandparents. For how many of you would that be true? For how many of you would you say that your grandparents, assuming they aren't American, if they are American, then go back further. How many of you would say that you are less tolerant or less generous than your grandparents who came from another culture? It's unusual. So why am I telling you this? You have choices to make. The one choice you can't make is to not want to fit in. Inherently, you want to fit in. You could choose to fit into what's beneficial and good and to sift out what's bad. Or you could choose not to think. Which is easier? To think or not to think? Which is easier? Not to think. So I want to give you an example of anti-think in American culture. In 1965, when I was in high school, they had a great World's Fair. So this World's Fair didn't feature so much booths from countries of the world like the Great World Fair that I think was in 39. I'm not sure when it was. It was mostly industrial. It had huge pavilions. One of the pavilions that was like enormous, was like the size of a football stadium, was GE. So you go into the GE pavilion, which like you have to wait hours online to get in. They strap you into this device that takes you through reality. So you have, you know, a circular film, so you're surrounded by on all sides by experience. And you're hearing the same mantra again and again. America will give you a better tomorrow with GE. So in case you were wondering, will America give you a better tomorrow? The answer is yes. How? General Electric. Okay. Do you think people actually thought that? Yes. The whole culture of success. You'll be happier if you're materially successful. Is something that we can't avoid. But you could choose how much of it to absorb. Okay, how many of you know people who are enormously successful materially? Is it accurate to say that all people who are materially successful are happy? No. Is it accurate to say that they're not happy? No. I want to tell you something. It doesn't make a difference. How do you measure happiness or unhappiness? So conventionally in sociology, the way you measure it is by three means. Suicide rates, okay, the presence or absence of depression, okay, and self-reported unhappiness. Okay, in the higher economic echelons, do you think there's more, less, or the same amount of suicide as in the middle class? What do you think?
More.
Okay, I'm just throwing that at you. So the myth isn't true, but we buy into it again and again. Give me an example of how we buy into the idea of this, that if we have more money, we'll be happier.
If we buy lots of
money. Right. Gambling. How else? Buying things you don't need. Okay. So we bought into it. Okay, now, that's one level of influence. So, how do people handle it when you buy out of their influence? How does society respond to you if you don't play by the rules? They don't know what to do with you. When I was a teenager, remember in those days, people didn't have computers, life, you had to entertain yourself more. So Sunday afternoons could be very long. So my friends and I sometimes would go downtown to the big shopping areas, and or to Port Authority. We had two games. Here's the Port Authority game. Go down to Port Authority with four friends. You look for a long line. Let's say bus is going to Stamford. Okay, you get online, all four of you. Okay, the line's moving. One of you goes, cuts the line and goes to the front. What will everybody say? What's going to happen if you cut a line? You're in New York City. What's going to happen if you cut a line? What do you think you're doing? You don't see there's a line? Get in line! Okay, so the person who cut the line then says, you think first come, first serve? I think might makes right. I'm getting ahead. Like, why is your view better than my view? What happens next? It's New York. Now, what happens next? Shut up! Get to the back of the law! Okay, now in the meantime, remember, he has three other friends. So the role of the friends is to say, hey, yeah, like, who says your rules are better than her rules, you know? Okay, you can get a lot of, like, if your goal is to get a lot of action, you get a lot of action. Okay, you could do this on the bus. Okay, on the bus, I never had the courage for the bus. Again, four girls at least. Somebody gets on the bus and won't pay. So I said, what do you mean you won't pay? You have to pay your fare. So, you think you should pay for services? I don't think you should pay for services. And again, the craziness, the shouting. Three other people say, yeah, who says you have to pay? Okay, whatever. Okay, people don't know what to do with you if you break the rules of societal norms. Accept that. But a much stronger influence is the influence of your friends. So, to fit into society, you want to accept the outside of what they have to offer. But with your friends, you want inner approval. So people tend to bend their beliefs and opinions to suit the beliefs and opinions of their friends. Could you see where this is so? The more their friendship is important to you, the more you'll bend. So, years ago, there was a Woody Allen movie called Zelig, which I can't imagine anybody in this room saw, even in reruns. Okay, in this movie, he became whoever he was with. So if he was with a woman, he became a woman. If he was a black person, he became black. Are there people who do this more or less? Yes, no? There are. Okay, when you're with your parents, you may be one way. With your friends, you become another way because you want both of their approval. You hear a lecture, you become a third way because it resonates as true. But then again, you revert to being what your friends want or your parents want 25 minutes after the lecture because you want their approval. What's the problem here? Or I should phrase it more objectively, is there a problem with with being three different people in the same day? What's the problem? The problem is you lose yourself. There's a verse in Mishlei, Bechal Mishmar Shishmar Libecha, more than you guard anything, guard your heart. Know who you are. You lose your identity. The people have no idea, under all of the different layers of self that they project to others to gain approval, who they really are. It's a human tragedy. There's a psychological theory that people put on innumerable masks because they're afraid that if people really knew them, they would reject them. I'm not sure that this theory is true, but I am sure that it's partially true. So let's go back to Shimon Bar Yochai. Part of maintaining integrity is to find the part of you that has something of Shimon Bar Yochai on the inside. Everybody in this room has a certain part of self that isn't influenced by society. Where does that come from? So I want to point something out that's very interesting to you. Jews have lived in many, many different kinds of society. So pretend that I have three Jews right here with me. Somebody from Moscow, somebody from Persia, and somebody from Ethiopia, and me. We're all Jewish. What makes us all part of anything that's the same? What do we share in common? Would you agree that we're all Jewish? So what do we share in common? So someone said, the same God. I want to tell you a secret. You're ready to hear something that you may not have heard? You ready? You sure? No one with a weak heart? Some Jews aren't religious. Okay, now you, so let's, this fellow from Moscow does not worship any God. Okay, what else makes us Jewish? Culture? Not me and the Ethiopian. History, would you say, if you look at history over the last 1,000 years, that the history of my family and this Ethiopian guy's family have much in common? Well, all humans, if you go far back enough, have some level of ancestral common lines. What makes us all Jewish? I don't hear you, I'm sorry. We're all in God's image, and what's Tim McCarthy? I don't hear you, I'm sorry. Okay, so let's talk about the Jewish soul and its reality as the internalized self. Okay, so in Pirkei Avot, it says that there are three traits that mark you off as Abraham's descendants. A sense of shame, a desire to do good, and a sense of mercy. Let's talk about these. Okay, in modern language, instead of using the word shame, I would use the word guilt. Are Jews good at guilt? How many of you think Jews are good at guilt? That's the old joke, that's why you're Jewish, if your mother is Jewish, because who else could see that that feeling of guilt will be perpetuated? Okay, tell me something good about guilt. Yeah? It keeps you on the straight and narrow. Guilt is marvelous. Okay, in the Middle Ages, you know about the ghettoization of Jews. Who determined that Jews should live in ghettos? Where did that idea come from? Was it the Jews or the Christians? No, whose idea was it? Nope, not in the Middle Ages. How many of you have been to Europe and seen any of the ghettos? Have any of you seen a ghetto? The ghetto of Rome, the ghetto of Prague? Okay, what do they look like? No, the person who raised her hand. Yeah? small, cramped, seven-story houses that were built in an era where there was no running water. Nobody chose that life. The Christian chose this life for the Jews. Why do you think they wanted us in ghettos? So I want to tell you why they wanted us in ghettos, and this is not a secret. It's very openly discussed in Christian theology. They thought we would disintegrate. They thought that if we lived in horrific circumstances, we would be reduced to being human beasts. We would become criminals, prostitutes, thieves, because that's what happens to people when they live in impossible circumstances much of the time. They thought we would live out lives of constant desperation and anger. Instead, we ended up producing people like Rashi. So I want to tell you an important component of why Jews didn't disintegrate. Guilt. Now, my mother grew up in the East Side during the immigrant era. It wasn't as bad as the ghettos. But nonetheless, it was always a wonder to me, like, I said, how did your parents keep the kids in school? Your Irish neighbors, your Italian neighbors didn't all succeed to the degree to which the Jews did. I said, I'll tell you how my father would have killed us. Okay, that's Jewish guilt. Could guilt be bad? Give me an example of bad guilt. Guilt could be bad when someone makes you feel bad about yourself, not for doing the wrong thing, but for not living up to their expectations. Are there Jewish guys who feel guilty because they're not doctors? Are there? Are there Jewish girls who feel guilty because they're oversized too? Okay. So guilt is bad when the object that's called evil is not evil. But guilt in a general sense is a good thing. Next, a need to do good. Do Jews like to do good? Are we do-gooders? Name a political movement, any kind of movement that excluded Jews. Any ism, feminism, Marxism, socialism, communism, were the Jews involved? Yes or no? Yes. The reason why we were involved is when we see injustice, we have a need to respond. Is this always good? No. It's only good if you know what you're doing. Okay, communism was, I don't know if you're aware of this, the early communists were predominantly Jewish, was a bad idea. It turned out to be a bad idea. Oops. How long does it take people to figure out it's a bad idea? 70 years. How many people got killed because of this bad idea? Millions. Oops. Okay, whatever. Okay, could be good, could be bad. Mercy means feeling somebody else's pain. Do we Jews tend to do this? Yes, no? Yes or no? Okay, we do. And again, sometimes it's good. Jews give a disproportionate amount of charity. And sometimes it's bad. We tend to even feel the pain of our enemies. So I want to conclude this part of our talk by telling you a true story. The story took place in Tzfat around 80 years ago. There was a scholar who lived in Tzfat who was known by his acronym. Okay, he was quite old at the time of this story. It was the anniversary of his father's death, and the custom is that any living son used the opportunity of the father's death to pray publicly to bring merit to his father's soul. Okay? So he's leading the prayers that day. It was a very cold day in Tzfat. He began to weep copiously. So somebody went over to him and said, you know, like, you're 82. You know, like, if your father was alive, he'd be like 100 and something. Why are you still mourning his death? So he said, there was something about the weather that reminded me of my father. So he said, what was it? So this is the story he told. The name of the skull was the Ridbaz, by the way. He said when he was a young kid, they lived in Poland, and even by the standards of the time, they were desperately poor. The whole family lived in one room. The room was partitioned. One part of the room was their parents' bedroom. And the rest of the room was the children's bedroom, the kitchen, the living room, and everything else. And his father had seasonal work. So in high season there was money, and in low season there wasn't. So one night, he's supposed to be sleeping, there's a knock on the door. He hears his father speaking to someone from his school. The school representative said to him, "You're behind 3 months in tuition. 12 weeks. You're supposed to pay a half a ruble a week. Here's 12 weeks. We can't keep your kid in school for free. The teachers have to eat. Every time I've asked you, you've had another excuse. Tomorrow, either send at least something to show that you have the intentions of pay, or don't send your son. You have to bring in something. If you can't send the whole amount you owe, at least send something." Now, the Radba said he was a little boy then, and he's already picturing it. He knew his father had no money. Will he be an apprentice? What's going to happen? Then he heard loud noise. The noise was so loud that he was afraid to open the curtain and peek to see what it was. It was only little. In the morning, he saw that what his father had done is that he took the crowbar to their wood-burning stove. He took it apart and went to the open-air market in the morning and sold the bricks and sent him to school with the money he got for the bricks. So he said, "I'll never forget that winter. Until the spring came and my father had work again, we had no cooked food. We had no heat. How could I have not grown to be a scholar after that kind of sacrifice?" That's a very Jewish story. That story isolates the essence of who we are. The yearning, the willingness to sacrifice, the holy guilt. So when you want to ask yourself, "And who am I without all the influence of society?" That's your core. This core finds its natural expression through the mitzvot. That's what the mitzvot are for, but that's your core. So you have to discover yourself. It gets buried under so much stuff, so much nonsense. So rediscovery of self, what's that good for? Why know yourself? So I'm going to give you a simplistic answer. You're the only one you got. When you dedicate your life to being something other than yourself, the loss is incomparable. You're the only self you have. So rediscovering that part, peeling away the layers of foreign influence, is important. But the fact is, we live in the world. What are we supposed to do about that? You're in college. You're not in the cave. So I'm going to tell you the formula. The first step is know who you are. Have a self. Next, take that self wherever you go, without apology, without a need to be something other. Take yourself wherever you go. That means, don't feel a need on the knee-jerk level to be something other than you. And not only don't take in unquestionably, give yourself to the environment. Take yourself where you are. Okay, so I want to tell you a true story of what this looks like. Okay, how many of you know who Natan Sharansky is? Could be worse, I'm impressed, okay? So, when he was freed, as you know, he was in prison in the Soviet Union for 9 years. Much of which was in solitary for trying to escape the Soviet Union. Tried to kidnap a plane, that's a no-no. They finally freed him. They freed him in East Germany, and he had to cross a little pedestrian bridge to get over to West Germany. He's not a good-looking man, which makes this story in many ways much more touching. He doesn't look heroic. Short, bald. Crosses over to the other side. Who's on the other side waiting for him? His wife, Avital, who had been campaigning for him for years. Who else? The press. Who Who do you think gets them first, Avital or the press? The press, of course. They're much more aggressive than she is. So they shove a microphone in his face, say, how does it feel to be free? You know what he said? He said, I was always free. He was always himself. So what I want you to think about is how you could be yourself in this environment. How could you be yourself? That means you have to adapt sovereignty. You have to be able to say, no one could make me be anything. I'll be who I want to be. In my mind, in my speech, in my actions. People will say, he made me angry. Is that sentence ever true? No. He gave me something to which I could respond with anger or not respond with anger, depending on who I am. People will say, my parents don't let me, and it doesn't matter what the end of the sentence is. Is that ever completely true? Not completely. So I'm going to conclude by telling you that you could be free and you could be you. And the choice is to discover the part of you that's your essential self and to never surrender it to your environment, but to take it to your environment and to uplift your environment and to glorify your environment. And I want to tell you what it looks like, which will be my last anecdote. I saw this story in a secular book, which is why it touched me so deeply. It was in the big bookstores in Manhattan, you could be there for years and they'll let you read forever. So there was a book of which a woman, her name was Barbara something, I don't even remember her last name anymore. She was writing about her upbringing, and this is a story she wrote. When she was a little girl, she lived in Brooklyn and went to the Brooklyn Academy of Music in downtown Brooklyn. And because at that time of day, the early morning, most of the people on the trains were going where? From Brooklyn to where? Brooklyn to Brooklyn? No, Brooklyn to Manhattan. The train was pretty empty. So she would see the same people going every day. So one of the people she saw was this middle-aged, religious-looking fellow. Now, to pass the time on the train, she'd read, and so would he. He read his books, she read her books. She was a child, she was with her mom. One day, just to make conversation, the religious guy said, what kind of books do you like? So she said, I like science fiction. And he says, do you like Isaac Asimov? And she said, yeah. Any of you like science fiction? Neither do I. Okay, whatever. And he said, in your fantasy, what's your like fantasy? What do you imagine? So she said, imagine like if people could go to the moon in rocket ships. Okay? And then he turned to him and said, and what's your fantasy? He said, I'd like to have an army of people and I'll send them all over the world to do acts of goodness and kindness. That's a fantasy, eh? The person who she was talking to was the Lubavitcher Rebbe when he was young. So what I want to tell you through this story is that you could live your fantasy and make changes and bring yourself to the world if that's what you want. So I'll stop now for questions if that's what you have. No questions? Yeah? Yeah. So as I said, the deepest self is the self I described, the self that wants to do good, that feels something towards others, that has a strong sense of guilt and importance towards evil. The reason why I'm saying that that's the deepest self is that that's the self that God promised the patriarchs would be retained in their descendants. Okay, yeah? It's tough. I'm not going to pretend it's an easy task. But you have to be able to hold up the outside to the mirror of truth. Is this true? Not only does it feel good, but is it true? Now, a tricky thing is that we humans have enormous capacity to distort truth to fit influence, to fit the environment. So I'll tell you an answer that you may like or may not like. The only truth we have that's objective comes from above us, which is the Torah. So you have to ask yourself, is this true? And then how could I live with it? That's where you discover it. That's where you discover it. Going, yeah.
You said these qualities are in the upper descendants?
Yes.
So is this specifically Jewish? Are these traits specifically Jewish or for all of our descendants?
So I'll tell you the exact progression. So Avram had two sons initially. Later, when after Sarah's death, he married Keturah, but leave that for a moment. Okay, Yishmael could have inherited all of these traits, but through his own choosing out of some of them, as it says in the text, God came to Avram prophetically and said, Yitzchak will be called your seed. So that excludes Yishmael's descendants. Okay, and because the other children were not as yet born, by the nature of things, even before they made choices, they were excluded from this. Yitzchak had two children, Yaakov and Esav. Again, they both could have been part of this. However, through his own choices, Esav excluded himself. So, how did Yaakov end up the chosen one? So the narrative in the text is as follows. Okay, Yaakov had been living in Laban's house. He had had to escape his own father's house because his brother Esav was out to kill him after he got the blessings. He lived in Laban's house for years. When he had his own family, he left. He was headed back to Israel. In order to get back to Israel from Iraq, which is where Laban lived, he had to cross the Avok River. How many of you have ever moved apartments? Any of you ever moved? Great pleasure? No. Okay, imagine what moving day was like if you had four wives, 12 sons, no truck. Okay, so you had to keep on going back and forth the Avok River all day. At the end of the day, when he had everybody on the right side of the Avok, he realized he had left some small dishes on the wrong side. He went back for them. Would you have gone back for them? I would not have gone back for them. He did. When he went back for them, what do you think he was thinking? So what he was thinking is that if anything is his, it's because God wants him to have it, to use, to uplift, to influence. It was that night that God made a covenant with him and said, your name won't be Yaakov any longer, it'll be Yisrael, which means Hashem will prevail, and made a covenant with him that his descendants will be part of this covenant forever, meaning there's no such thing anymore of any descendant of Yaakov leaving the fold. Okay. Going once. Going, yeah?
To what degree are we supposed to involve ourselves in society around us?
So you have to have a good sifter. You have to be able to take out of the society everything that's beneficial and useful. And you have to be able to say no to everything that isn't. You have to have a good sifter. So an example of having a good sifter would be, let's say, being a successful broker, making lots of money and giving lots of charity without becoming a materialist, which isn't an easy job. Or becoming somebody who's a literary personage, a poet or a writer, and seeking to write not only what feels right and what expresses self, but what brings some light to the world. So the world was given to us to uplift and to use, not to ignore, but you have to have a good sifter. Going twice. That's it.
Thank you. I know she discussed it with Yehava. Right, so she... But I only heard one half of it, so I don't...
Nelson's going to be there tonight?
Tonight.
How
would you feel that title?
73rd, well, she's sure,
right? Right, exactly. Okay.
Same thing, or is it different?
No. We're talking about current events, how to find, like, basically how to find inspiration in the current world.
Usually an hour
long?
Usually
about. Not all of them have a price on it.
I think they're all 8. Yeah.
Some of them had a...
Some are a little more, but...
Yeah. How much are they?
They're all 8.
They're almost all 8. A few of them are a little bit more, but most of them are all 8.
Oh, what are these?
I'm not really sure what that looks like. I need to get my glasses on. I know it's a lot more.
It's like 30 something.
Are they all empty crates?
I don't think so. I think really just that one.
Alright, so I'm gonna get
three. One thing is, I didn't know we were doing this.
That's one thing. Actually, it's 25.
I have one too.
Perfect.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
I have a little bit of change. I didn't realize we were going to be selling here. I'm sorry. Okay, so let me just 16, right? What you have, and you have a 20? What do I have here? Okay. I have oh, wait, no.
Thank you so much.
Sure, my pleasure. Thank you. I'm sorry. Can I go, oh, I'm supposed to be recording.
Oh, gosh. I got money change.
Yeah, I feel so bad. You don't have to pay for
change. I have no
money. I feel terrible. You might have to go to the bank.
Here, you give me back.
Okay.
I leave 16, right? Does that make sense?
And you gave, yeah, so, right.
So let me give you 20.
Okay, that's great. Oh.
Here,
that makes sense, right?
Yes, thank you. I should be writing this down. Hold on a second. Thank you.